All in the nuclear family today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. George Bunn negotiated non-proliferation treaties during the Cold War. Now his son, Matthew Bunn, worries about groups like ISIS.
If they ever turn to nuclear weapons, they've got more money, more people, more territory under control, more ability to recruit experts globally than Al-Qaeda at its best ever had.
Plus, a state of the economy in Venezuela.
I saw milk at a grocery this week for the first time in a year and a half, but it's priced maybe four times higher than it used to be.
And the Standing Rock Sioux get global support for their Dakota Pipeline protest.
Norway, Central America, the Philippines. It's truly one of the biggest environmental fights on the view of a lot of indigenous peoples right now.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. Good to have you with us today. Tense politics and big protests. We've got plenty of both on the show, including an update on the protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's coming up in a few minutes. We begin, though, in Venezuela. Massive street protests there this week calling for President Nicolas Maduro to step down. The Venezuelan opposition says he's to blame for the country's economic problems, which include soaring prices and food shortages.
I saw milk at a grocery this week for the first time in a year and a half.
Wow. A year and a half?
But it's priced maybe four times higher than it used to be.
Hannah Dreyer reports for the Associated Press from the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. So the leaders opposed to President Nicolas Maduro called for a 12-hour general strike today. Apparently they've been happening all over Venezuela. What form have they been taking in the capital?
It's pretty quiet in the capital. There's really no traffic during what should be rush hour. The metro is emptier. Some shops and schools are closed. But the government made a threat yesterday that they would expropriate any business that shut down. And the secret police massed outside of the mansion of the country's largest business owner. So a lot of people are worried. And we're not seeing the total shutdown of the country that I think the opposition was hoping for.
You mentioned that President Maduro has threatened to seize control of companies that join the strike. This sounds pretty unprecedented. Can Maduro do this as he started doing it?
He is doing it. They've said that they will take over any shop that closes today. So while workers might be staying home, it would have to be a very brave business owner to shut down operations.
And protesters are chanting democracy, yes, dictatorship, no. What is the sense when you actually speak with people on the street? Do they see this as kind of the end game being getting Maduro out?
A lot of Venezuelans are asking themselves this week if the country has become a dictatorship. Last week, the government shut down the best democratic option for getting President Maduro out of office, which was a recall election. This week, Venezuelans are very worried. People are turning out in huge numbers to protest the Maduro administration. But the government's response has really just been more authoritarianism, so more going after protesters. And people are starting to ask themselves if they're going to be willing to die in the streets. There was a big protest movement 2 years ago where 40 people were killed. It's looking like it's going to take something like that to really make a change here.
It sounds really kind of at a pivotal moment for Venezuela. Are Venezuelans clear about what or who they want next, aside from we want to eat and we'd like a little more money?
Venezuelans are clear that they don't like what's happening right now. 80% of the country wants President Maduro gone. But they're also very angry with the opposition. Even at a major protest this week where maybe 500,000 people turned out, people were saying they don't trust opposition leaders to keep taking to the streets, to keep the pressure up. People want to change, but they don't seem to really trust any leaders right now to help them achieve it.
Yeah, and that seems kind of emblematic of this whole recall campaign. The government election authorities blocked it. I mean, it really does feel like crisis is where this is all headed. Do you hear from Venezuelans that they think it's going to be violent?
People are worried that it's going to be violent, and I think people are also hoping that it's going to be violent. There aren't a lot of options right now for the opposition. They've been pretty much totally shut out of the democratic process. And even when they stage these big, peaceful demonstrations, nothing seems to happen. There was a video that went viral this week of a young, very skinny student shouting in the face of a heavily armed soldier on a police line at one of these protests. And he's shouting, "I'm starving. Are you going to kill me because I'm starving? Then kill me because I can't take it anymore." And the soldier is just there kind of impassively. I think a lot of Venezuelans saw the whole situation in that video. People are furious. They're trying to get attention, and the government just isn't responding.
I'm curious, whose side is the army on? Because that was the MO for the late Hugo Chavez.
I mean, that's the question of the hour here. Everyone's hoping the army's on their side, especially in Venezuela, where the army traditionally is the decider of these political crises. They're key, but it's kind of a black box. One thing we do hear is that even people at the barracks are going hungry. So when you have hungry soldiers, anything could happen.
Hannah Dreyer with the Associated Press in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. Thank you very much, Hannah.
Good talking with you.
It's also been tense in Martin County, North Dakota. That's where more than 300 people had been camped out on a stretch of disputed land that's slated for a stretch of oil pipeline. Yesterday, police cleared the camp and arrested more than 140 protesters in a violent clash that brought charges of excessive force and provocation from both sides. Reporter Jenny Monet has been on the scene and joins us now from nearby Fort Yates, North Dakota. Tell us what the scene is at the camp.
Sure, Marco. My understanding is that the Morton County Sheriff's Department has actually taken over that region known as the Treaty Camp and have blocked anyone from even approaching that area. And so whatever we saw yesterday of them dismantling this camp, those were my last scenes from the chaos that erupted yesterday.
Yeah. What were emotions like yesterday as the camp was being cleared out?
Extremely tense. Some of the most intense kind of confrontation that I've seen throughout this occupation, which has its roots all the way back to April. What we saw was a line of police in riot gear, wielding batons and a host of other weapons. Some were using tasers on protesters. Pepper spray was employed. Two armored tanks were slowly rolling on the highway, pushing the protesters back. The goal for Sheriff's Department was to move the demonstrators back to their original encampment about 10 miles south on Highway 1806.
Yeah, you spoke with some demonstrators who sounded pretty fraught during all of this.
Yeah, so for the people here, what folded before their eyes yesterday was not only a fight for water, but taking a stand to defend lands that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe have declared as a sacred site. Yesterday, as bulldozers scraped away at this contested land, Carol Gonzalez, a youth organizer, wept and yelled at the line of officers who later arrested her. She was screaming, "These are sacred lands. Those are our ancestors."
"That's a cemetery you're digging up! That's a cemetery! That's burial ground!"
So, Jenny, we're talking the protesters, we're talking local natives with the Standing Rock Sioux, but also a lot of others, correct?
That's correct. This has been a groundswell of support. What we saw in early September were more than 300 tribal nations that had descended on the original encampment. But also we saw a groundswell of support coming from international indigenous peoples, Norway, Central America, the Philippines. And it's truly one of the biggest environmental fights on the view of a lot of indigenous peoples right now.
And tell us in as simple terms as possible what the two sides are essentially fighting over.
From the side of the demonstrators, their core fight is to protect the water. The Missouri River is the ribbon of water that would be carrying the pipeline underneath. And of course, the tribe's concern is that any rupture of this pipeline would contaminate their water, not only for them, but 17 million other Americans that rely on the Missouri. On the side of the pipeline, obviously, it's a $3.7 billion project, nearly 1,200 miles long, and pumping crude up to 570,000 barrels a day.
We know that in the last couple of weeks, a number of journalists have also been arrested. They've been charged with trespassing, even rioting in some cases. What about you and other journalists? Are you still operating under threat of arrest?
Well, yesterday there was that concern. Journalists have repeatedly been arrested. I spoke with one who works for The Guardian who was detained for 48 hours.
So this land is owned by the pipeline company, but members of the Standing Rock Sioux say the land was taken from them illegally more than a century ago. So with over 140 arrests and the protest camp cleared, does the tribe have any traction anymore to make its case?
That was central to what led to yesterday's standoff. The tribe symbolically took over this plot of land that sits right in the path of this pipeline that was part of this historic 1851 treaty land. I'm currently asking questions about how much traction that carries. But on the other side, I know that there have been repeated calls to President Obama to intervene and to stop this pipeline. And one thing that I repeatedly heard was that this fight is not over.
Reporter Jenny Monet in Fort Yates, North Dakota, not too far from the recently cleared protest camp in Morton County. Thanks very much, Jenny.
Thanks, Marco.
Immigration has been a big theme in the presidential election, as you know. Donald Trump talks about it a lot on the campaign trail, but he doesn't often mention his own immigrant roots. His mother, Mary Ann McLeod, was born and raised on the Isle of Lewis off Scotland's northwest coast. It was a remote and rugged place when she left at the age of 17, and it still is. Reporter Carol Zoll went there recently and talked to people about their Trump connection.
I've been to Lewis lots of times. I have friends here. But on this trip, I'm thinking about something I've never really contemplated before. Donald Trump's connection to this island. He must have heard stories about this place when he was growing up, maybe about the island's Viking history or about its strict religion. The Sabbath is still a day of rest here. Only 7 years ago, there were protests when the ferry finally started sailing on Sundays. And Trump certainly would have heard about the landscape, the beautiful beaches, the harsh weather, and the almost complete absence of trees.
It's not a very big island, but it's not a very small island either.
Leslie Guy is a postman who lives on the west side of Lewis. His dog, Cecil, is helping him round up some sheep.
Ah! Cecil!
Good boy.
Lie down there!
Lie down.
I ask Les what people here think of Donald Trump. His response is diplomatic.
Everybody does know Donald Trump, but what people think of him exactly, I don't know. He does make the headlines. For the right reasons, the wrong reasons. Well, I would say the wrong reasons myself, but...
There are 20,000 people in Lewis, but it still feels like a place where everyone knows everyone. Rory Cunningham works for a car rental company at the local airport. He says people here have known for years about Trump's family history.
You know, we sort of almost boast a little bit about it, but then once it came to light, the sort of views, try to distance ourselves from it.
Trump still has family on the island, but Cunningham says they're not so quick these days to claim Trump as their own.
Like, I know his family don't openly tell people that they are, you know, his first cousins. He clearly, from what I can tell, his mother's influence of island life and acceptance and being humble, I would say, has not been passed down to him.
My friend Bill McLeod grew up about 10 miles north of Tongue, the village where Trump's mother was raised. Bill lives in Glasgow now, but his parents are still in Lewis. I asked him whether he'd heard people talking about Trump's island roots.
Yeah, I've heard very little else when I'm up in Lewis. It's a talk of the town. I think people are quite amused. I mean, the disjunction between Trump, this kind of larger-than-life figure with rather extreme views, and Lewis, whether it's the landscape or the psychology of Lewis, is quite at odds.
Another friend, Chrisella Ross, says she thought the Trump connection was interesting at first, but then it just became embarrassing.
Because you do get linked, you know, if you get told, oh, that person is from your place, it sort of means that person is you, that person is like you. And I don't think many people here would want to ever think that they were like him. I think he represents a total anathema of what these islands are.
Most people I spoke with in the island either joked about Trump or were deeply critical of him. But Rory Cunningham did try to find something positive to say.
There was a charity night for cancer research which was thrown up here, and one of his cousins is actually on the committee for the cancer research up here. So as a prize for that charity night, he did give 4 nights in one of his hotels in Las Vegas for free.
For the World, Carol Zoll, Lewis, Scotland.
You're listening to The World. Unintended consequences. That usually means bad consequences, but in the story we're about to hear, they're actually good. It starts with the U.S.-backed fight against extremists in Pakistan. A huge number of civilians have been displaced by it. The World's Carolyn Beeler visited one displaced family in Islamabad, the capital, and was surprised by the impact on the women and children. Here's the latest story in our series, Balance of Power.
It took the Khans 2 years to build their family house in North Waziristan. They had 3 days to flee.
The situation was all of a sudden worse.
This is Seema Khan. Her family left their newly built home in June of 2014. That's when the Pakistani military launched a U.S.-backed offensive targeting extremists in the northwest border region. About 1 million people fled that year. They left farm fields, livestock, and houses full of memories behind.
Missing everything like my house, my precious household items and all that, furniture, everything which I loved, I'm missing all that.
I'm talking with Khan in the sitting room of the Islamabad apartment where she lives now. Four families share this two-story apartment, and the women almost never leave.
Being a Pashtun lady, we don't go out from our houses.
This is Haula Khan, Seema's daughter. She's in her mid-20s, and in Waziristan, she says they could leave the family compound to visit relatives. But now everyone is scattered. When I sat talking with the Khan women, I expected them to tell me how much they missed home and wanted to go back. How the military operation that the U.S. will pay up to $900 million for this year has made their lives worse. They do miss their home, but even though they're stuck in this tiny apartment, they tell me their lives have actually gotten better since being displaced. Here's Seema Khan again.
We are kind of happy here than Waziristan because there are the basic facilities. Our children are getting education and we are living in a very peaceful environment. While in Waziristan, we were lacking such kind of facilities.
Five-year-old Iman Khan was wearing her school uniform and backpack when we got to the family's house. She wouldn't have been able to go to school back home. Her sister Haula never did.
Her future will be bright. She will be happy. She won't be uneducated like us because she has an opportunity here. She's getting her education.
They have better access to health care here, too. Asma Khan, who married into the Khan family, starts to tell me about the danger of childbirth in Waziristan. She looks uncomfortable talking about the subject. Our interpreter asks Asma's husband to leave so she can speak more freely. Asma Khan says there were no female doctors near their old home who could help during life-threatening deliveries.
When there aren't any female specialists, we get referred to male doctors, and the men in our family won't let us be treated by these male doctors. As a result, many women have died during childbirth.
The Khan women aren't the only ones to say that in some ways their lives are better post-displacement. Gender rights advocate Rukhshanda Naz has interviewed more than 150 displaced women since the U.S.-backed offensive started 2 years ago.
When we interacted with women in different camps and in the host community, we considered displacement for women an opportunity as well.
She says for the first time, they had access to literacy programs and healthcare, initiatives the U.S. also spends millions on here each year.
Some of the women they shared with us, we the first time we got importance, someone think about us, they gave us chance to improve our lives.
Yeah, I'm getting a good news.
Back at the Khan house, in the middle of our interview with his sister, Haula, Amir Khan looks up from his cell phone to tell us he's just read some news. The government has given the region's tribal leaders permission to return to Waziristan.
Our villages will go back within 1 month.
Khan's family will be allowed to go back. Nobody really wants to, though, especially the women. Their family house has been ransacked and overtaken by weeds. But staying here in Islamabad, that may not be an option. Right now, the family gets about $180 a month from the government. Once that stops, Asma Khan doesn't know if they could afford to stay in the city.
We're wondering how we'll earn money, how would we pay the rent, and how would we get a job?
As I left the Khan family after our interview and walked down the street, I looked back at their house. One of the women was peeking out from behind the tarp on their balcony that's there to shield them from the outside world. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Islamabad.
As part of our Balance of Power series, we've been asking this question. If you had $1 billion to help women in your country, what would you do? $1 billion is how much the U.S. spends on gender programs around the globe each year. Our reporter in Colombia asked Leonora Converse for her answer. Leonora said that women are always the ones made most vulnerable by wars, so she would spend money to care for the most vulnerable and educate people about women's rights. We want your answers, too. How would you spend $1 billion for women in your country? Tweet your answer at Women's Lives using the hashtag Balance of Power and follow Across Women's Lives on Snapchat, also at Women's Lives, for daily videos of women around the world answering the $1 billion question. Katie Nelson is an American photojournalist living in Nairobi, Kenya. Every week she visits a bookstore there to rifle through old magazines. This week she found something that would make any photojournalist's hands shake with excitement, a June 1985 issue of National Geographic. That is the iconic issue with the Afghan girl on the cover, you know, the one with the piercing green eyes. Her name is Sharbat Gula. And after that photo was taken, Gula became the symbol of the refugee crisis in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Nelson says finding the actual magazine in this age of digital pictures made her think about the photo differently.
In print, it's an actual human being, and the portrait looks like a woman who just has the most stellar, amazing green eyes you've ever seen. And there's this sadness about her, but intensity that just doesn't come off in a screen.
Right before Nelson found the magazine, Sharbat Gula was in the news again. She'd been arrested on charges that she was using forged documents.
She was in Pakistan and she's Afghani, but she's been a refugee all of her life. And apparently officials came in and found that she had forged documents, ID cards, and was living in Pakistan illegally. At least that's what the officials say.
Katie Nelson says Gula's recent arrest shows that not much has changed for refugees in the last 31 years, and that's why the photo is just as powerful today. Back in that bookstore in Nairobi, Nelson thought there was no way the owner would let her take the magazine without paying a lot of money. Still, it was worth a shot.
I just nested it between a couple of other National Geographic magazines that I was purchasing, but of course he found it. He still let me go home with it.
The price?
$2.47.
Apparently, the store owner is trying to get rid of used magazines and books because he says people are not reading them anymore, so he's selling them at extremely low prices. If I'm ever back in Nairobi, I know where I'm going. By the way, that picture from the Afghan Girl issue that Katie Nelson bought, you can see it right now at PRI.org. You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. A Saudi woman wants to be a singer, but her culture won't allow it.
I just wanted to escape that prison-like feeling.
So she moved to Pakistan.
I know that when I'm in Pakistan, I'm just who I want to be. Pakistan is a place where I can be myself.
Our series on women in Pakistan continues. Hashtag Balance of Power on the World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I remember the first time I discovered a fallout shelter. It was marked by that yellow sign with the black pinwheel. It was in the basement of the school where I used to take violin lessons. It smelled disused, as if in the 1970s no one really expected a nuclear attack anymore. The whole idea of hiding out in that basement until a radiation all clear was kind of ludicrous, but there were the tubs of preserved food and distilled water from the early 60s, just in case of nuclear attack. It's hard to wrap your head around nukes, maybe because the thought of them detonating with that iconic mushroom cloud above your head is so scary and really incomprehensible. Here's the thing, though. No matter how much the world has changed and other threats like terrorism and global warming dominate our fears, nuclear dangers are still with us. But every day there are ordinary people collaborating in extraordinary ways to keep the rest of us safe from those dangers. Over the next few months, we're going to tell the stories of some of those people for a project we're calling the Nuclear Family. And we're going to start with Matthew Bunn of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard. He is not the first in his family to choose a career in arms control. His father, George Bunn, was instrumental in drafting the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which went into effect in 1970. Matthew Bunn, thanks for being with us. Let's start at the beginning. When did your father first encounter nuclear weapons?
So he was on a ship bobbing around in the Pacific at the end of World War II, which was slated to be part of the invasion of Japan. And he honestly believed that his life was saved by dropping the bomb on Japan.
In other words, he never actually got to be part of that invasion. The bomb dropped and he's out on that ship.
Exactly. And so he ended up ferrying people back from the war rather than participating in the war. So he came back to Madison, Wisconsin, where he'd grown up, and became a physics graduate student. And his father gave him a copy of the Acheson Lilienthal report, which laid out a concept for global international control of all aspects of nuclear technology to ensure disarmament. And he thought, well, if we're going to have disarmament, we're going to need treaties. If we're going to have treaties, we're going to need lawyers. So I'll go off to law school. So he went off to law school specifically with the idea of controlling the bomb.
So with all this stuff swirling around your father, would you call what he kind of ended up doing in law, kind of shifting from physics to law, as an awakening?
Absolutely, it was an awakening. And it's actually just personally an odd transition, because he became a physics graduate student because he was so shy that he wanted to have a job where he could be in a lab and not talk to anyone. And then he became a lawyer and international diplomat.
Yeah, where you have to talk to a lot of people.
All the time.
In 1947-48, how many details did the world know about what had happened in Hiroshima, kind of like the destruction? And how much was he aware of that?
It didn't come out instantly, although there were, you know, global news stories literally the days immediately after the bombings. In fact, Bernard Brody, who later became one of the founders of the whole field of nuclear strategy, had been a naval strategist and went to the drugstore to buy the paper the day after Hiroshima, looked at the headline and turned to his wife and said, "Everything I've ever written is obsolete."
Wow. Well, why did he come to that conclusion?
Because one bomb from one plane could destroy an entire city. That was something dramatically different than anything that had come before. It was a new kind of threat to civilization. I mean, after all, we had just, as a world, gone through a war that had killed tens of millions of people. And the notion that our species would now have bombs available to it where a single bomb could destroy an entire city was just terrifying. At one point, years later, Einstein was asked what weapons World War III would be fought with. And he said, "Well, I don't know, but I can tell you what weapons World War IV will be fought with." And the interviewer said, "Well, how on earth would you know that?" He said, "Sticks and stones."
Right. Yeah. So when your father would come home from work, once he started kind of really trying to curb the spread of nuclear weapons, how did those conversations kind of unfold? Like, you know, did he talk about what he was afraid of? Did he talk about what kind of narratives he was concerned about for the future?
Well, to be honest, I was too young when he was doing most of that work to really understand or participate in those conversations. I got involved when I went off to college, and by that time it was the late 70s and the Cold War was at its peak. The Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. People were worried about nuclear war. And about that time, the freeze movement got moving. And it turned out my father was the only person in Wisconsin who had ever actually negotiated with the Russians about nuclear arms. And so he began getting invitations to give talks all over the place. And he thought to himself, you know, that was the part of my career that was most exciting and fulfilling. I should go back to doing that. Mm. And so late in life, he returned to nuclear weapons and arms control at a time when I was already working on the subject. And very late in his career, he and I ended up working on more or less the same topics.
How did each of your disciplines of study kind of shape how you each entered this business, if we can call it that? I mean, you went to MIT. Were you a scientist?
Well, I started off at MIT with the idea of majoring in physics. Ended up, when I got interested in nuclear weapons, focusing on the intersection between the technology and the policy, and ended up with my degree actually in political science in the end. And I've always focused more on the technology of nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and so on, and the policies that are needed to manage the danger. My father, on the other hand, as a lawyer, focused mainly on the treaties and the legal aspects and the sort of international organizations and norms. Toward the end of his career, after the 9/11 attacks, actually even leading up to the 9/11 attacks, both of us had gotten involved in the question of security for nuclear weapons and the materials needed to make them to keep them from falling into terrorist hands. Immediately after 9/11, there was a global international meeting at the International Atomic Energy Agency, where my father and I both spoke on this topic of security for nuclear weapons and materials. And he said at that meeting, if I had known then what I know now about what terrorists could potentially do, I would have tried to make sure that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty included provisions to require that all of these weapons and materials be secure.
So in that sense, I'm curious, do you feel like you picked up the baton from your father, kind of really looking at, you know, loose nuclear material and the possibility that that might end up in extremist hands?
Well, I think on that topic, he and I came to it at about the same time. And in fact, I think I may have gotten to it first. When the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, 25 years ago, next month, the reality is that most of their security system fell apart with it. It was designed for a closed society with closed borders, everyone closely watched by the KGB and nuclear workers who had the best of everything Soviet society had to offer. And all of that went away. They literally had, you know, gaping holes and fences at nuclear facilities and highly enriched uranium stored in what you and I would think of as the equivalent of a high school gym locker with a padlock that could be snapped with a bolt cutter from any hardware store. There was one case where the thief who stole kilograms of highly enriched uranium didn't even bother with a bolt cutter. He took an iron rod and just put it, you know, inside the padlock and twisted and just broke the padlock and made the mistake of leaving the broken padlock lying in the snow, which otherwise nobody would have noticed for a long time that
That's
the theft had occurred. So I got involved in the early 90s working on with Russia to try to make sure all of this nuclear material was locked down. And my father then got involved in those topics as well. And ultimately, we did – in the entire course of our careers, remarkably, we only wrote one joint article together.
Do you wish you had written more together? Do you think you could have been kind of doubly productive?
Oh, I don't know if we could have been doubly productive, but it would have been fun. One of the hilarious incidents was I was at that time the editor of the leading journal in the field, which is called Arms Control Today. And my father and a colleague of his had written an article about who ends up with the legal rights under different treaties for the Soviet Union of all these new states arising out of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And there was a sentence in that article, I read it five times. I could not understand what the heck it said. And I called up my dad and I said, "Dad, what the heck are you trying to say here?" And he said, "Well, we couldn't agree on that one, so we intentionally wrote it so you couldn't understand what it said." I said, "I'm sorry. As editor of this magazine, I am not putting in a sentence that even the author doesn't know what it means. You guys figure out what you want to say or I'm taking it out."
Generally, what was it like working with your father, George Bunn?
Both of my parents had a feeling that you can't waste your life on this planet. You have to not only try to make yourself happy, but try to make the rest of the world a better place than it would have been if you'd never been here. And I think that basic attitude toward life was definitely absorbed by the children.
You've got two daughters. Do they care about nukes as much as you and their grandfather?
Absolutely not. I think I have unfortunately managed to convince both of them that science is a boring thing that Daddy wants us to be interested in.
So today, Matthew Bunn, I Google nuclear. Pretty much any day there are things going on, big, small. And I'm just curious, in the context of the current presidential race where the word nuclear often goes, shall we say, nuclear pretty fast, as in whom do we trust with the nuclear codes? What occurs to you as to where we've evolved to on nukes, and where do we go from here?
Well, I candidly have found the current election quite depressing. One thing is that until very recently, most Americans have largely forgotten about nuclear dangers. Many people thought that the nuclear danger went away when the Cold War went away, and unfortunately, that's not true. We have thousands of nuclear weapons in the world today, thousands of them, in fact, ready for immediate launch. And the next president is going to face some very serious nuclear dangers. We have a very unpredictable dictator in North Korea that now has close to a couple of dozen nuclear weapons, is producing more, testing longer-range ballistic missiles. We have a nuclear deal with Iran, but some of the key provisions only last for a short period of time. And so the next president is going to have to figure out how to use the time that we've bought with that deal. We have an unbelievable crisis in relations with Russia, where there's a real war scare going on today in Moscow. They've just mobilized 40 million people across the country in a civil defense drill. And there's talk on the news about the coming war with the United States. And I think there are very real dangers of inadvertent conflict, whether it be in the Baltics or elsewhere in Europe. We're getting into some serious tensions with China, and we still have the issue of terrorists. Yes, we've taken out Osama bin Laden, but now we have the Islamic State, and we don't have a lot of evidence that they have the kind of focused nuclear weapons effort that al-Qaeda did have. But there are some hints, and if they ever turn to nuclear weapons, they've got more money, more people, more territory under control, more ability to recruit experts globally than al-Qaeda at its best ever had. So I think we need a president with very careful and sober judgment when handling nuclear issues. I look back at the Cuban Missile Crisis, and in the early days, Kennedy's advisors were almost unanimous in saying, you've got to launch airstrikes on Cuba and then invade. And Kennedy pushed back and said, there's got to be another way. Mm. And we now know, as they didn't then, that there were already nuclear weapons in Cuba and that the people there had the physical capability to launch them. And so had we not had a president with really sober judgment, we might not exist as a civilization today.
How do you sleep at night?
Well, the reality is that we've made an immense amount of progress through sensible policies over the years. More than half of all the countries that once had potential nuclear bomb material on their soil have gotten rid of it. We've reduced nuclear weapons by more than 80% around the world. And we've managed to avoid nuclear conflict and put in place sensible arms restraint measures with verification, and bit by bit, we're making those stronger. I've had the experience in my career of, you know, making a suggestion, convincing governments to try to pursue that suggestion and seeing it make the world a safer place. And I really think there's almost nothing more satisfying than that experience. And my father had that experience as well. You know, he was one of the key negotiators, perhaps the most important of the U.S. negotiators, of the most important nuclear arms treaty of all time, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it's a satisfying life if you can actually make some progress, and I feel like we have.
That was Matthew Bunn of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard. His father, George Bunn, was an American diplomat and non-proliferation expert. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, a Saudi singer who found freedom and her voice in Pakistan. But first, let's take a trip in the Wayback Machine. Back in 2004, Jamie Hiscox was walking on the beach in the south of England when he spotted a small brown pebble, just a few inches across. He could easily have kept walking, but he thought it had an unusual shape. So he picked it up and took it home. Turns out now that what Hiscox pocketed wasn't a pebble at all. According to a new scientific paper, that small rock was a brain. Well, about 130 million years ago, it was a brain, a dinosaur brain, now fossilized. Alex Liu of Cambridge University is part of the team studying the brain, and he says this is the first time that dinosaur gray matter has ever been found in this condition.
It's remarkably unexpected, actually, that we're finding soft tissue preserved in a brain particularly. The brain particularly is usually locked up inside the skull and never has chance to come into contact with sediment. And so it was previously considered that finding a fossilized brain, or at least the soft tissues of it, would be very, very unlikely indeed.
Scientists say the brain probably belonged to a relative of the iguanodon, a slow-moving plant-eating dinosaur. The brain is so well-preserved that it's possible to make out tiny blood vessels on its surface. Liu says they think that other structures may also be intact deeper inside this pickled brain, all of which raises the possibility that other parts of dinosaurs may be preserved around us without anyone having noticed. So next time you're at the beach, watch your step. Before we leave you this week, we're going to check in one last time with our Across Women's Lives team in Pakistan. The World's Carolyn Beeler joins me from Islamabad. So all this week, Carolyn, you've been sharing some amazing, really great personal stories of women who are role models for their communities, and some are even role models for their whole country. You've got one more story for us today. Tell us what this is.
Hey, Marco. Yeah, that is right. Before signing off from Pakistan, I want to introduce you to one more woman who actually came to Pakistan because of the freedom that it affords her here. She's a singer-songwriter named Rutaba Yaqub, and she moved here from Saudi Arabia to study engineering when she was in her teens. And for Yaqub, that meant freedom from Saudi Arabia's more strict Islamic laws. So she always knew that she could sing, but when she moved here to Pakistan, she started singing in public at her university. And at 19 years old, she was discovered by a music producer who's kind of a big deal here. You can think of him as like Simon Cowell, but nicer. and she started singing backup for his television music show. It's a variety show that's popular here. But doing a cover from her favorite band helped move her up the food chain in music from backup singer to headliner. And that cover was a really stunning version of Coldplay's The Scientist. Sky could fall.
This is really, really impressive, Carolyn. I heard a taste of it. I'm glad we got another taste for our listeners. How has she been able to leave behind conservative life in Saudi Arabia and adapt to kind of a different sort of conservative life in Pakistan?
Well, this is sort of where Rutaba fits into the rest of the reporting that we've done here in Pakistan. So we came here looking for stories of how decisions made in the U.S., so U.S. foreign policy, impacts women here in Pakistan. And that's really a mixed bag. Some women are winners and some women are losers when it comes to what the U.S. is doing here. But the one thing that we found was a constant for nearly all of the women we spoke to for our reporting was that the women who were able to succeed in whatever their sphere were able to do so because they have family support, and more specifically, male family member support, mostly fathers. So, you know, it was really interesting to discover that obviously here there are women doing really amazing things, but basically when they're given the latitude to by their male family members.
So she's got family support. Does she have fans and enough support from Pakistanis there that she's going to stay in Pakistan, make it her home?
Yeah, she has a good amount of support from all over the world, really. She's kind of tapped into fans all over the globe. And she's sort of, I'd say, an emerging star here. She was named in the local English paper as one of the five women songwriters to watch. But on a more personal note, her family is still in Saudi Arabia, but her work and her life and, importantly, her music are all here.
I know that when I'm in Pakistan, I'm just myself. I'm just who I want to be. But in Saudi Arabia, I'm what my parents expect me to be, what my parents' friends expect me to be, or their or my relatives want me to be, you know. So in that sense, Pakistan is a place where I can be myself.
So she'll continue being herself, but we heard her covering Coldplay. I mean, she really captured that dark, brooding quality of Coldplay in her cover, The Scientist. But what about her own music?
Yeah, absolutely. Rutaba says she's done with covers. She's writing her own music. Her new EP is called Échappé, the French word for escape. And Rutaba says she called it that because she wanted to escape after her family, you know, sort of started putting pressure on her to move back to Saudi Arabia after she finished her engineering studies. But she stuck it out here in Pakistan. Hold on, just a little longer. I'm in love with your words.
So darling, hold on. And her family approves of her life these days, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. She said she asked her father over and over if staying here and pursuing her music was okay. And he said yes. You know, they just want her to be happy.
Well, we are going to watch the emerging career of Saudi singer Rutaba Yaqub as she advances forward in Pakistan. It's been really great to meet her. Thanks for introducing us to Rutaba Yaqub, Carolyn, as well as everybody else, the amazing women we've met this week. It's been really, really great.
Thanks, Marco. Yeah, it's been a real privilege to be able to meet them and tell their stories.
Carolyn Beeler, who's been reporting on our Across Women's Lives series from Pakistan this week. We're going to go out with some more of Saudi singer Rutaba Yaqub, one of her new original songs. Really cool stuff. That's When I'm Gone by Saudi singer Rutaba Yaqub in Pakistan. Our stories this week from Pakistan are part of a series we're calling Balance of Power. It examines how U.S. foreign policy impacts women all across the globe. And next week, our series turns to Colombia. For over half a century, a civil war has consumed Colombia. Now some of the guerrillas who spent years fighting in the jungle are trying to move on. We're going to hear from some of the women among them.
La verdad, ¿usted quiere que yo le diga la verdad? Sí.
This former rebel says, "You want me to tell you the honest truth? I miss that life." We'll have stories about Colombia's war, women, and U.S. foreign policy all next week on the show. That'll do it for us on this Friday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the weekend. We're back with you all on Monday.
PRI. Public Radio International.